I'm interviewing you to re-inform people that every day there are migrant workers and no-status peoples who are killed or maimed on the job in Canada. Also, informing people that recently, on Christmas Eve, 4 men died on the job. So, please introduce yourself to listeners out there, Tony.
Okay, my name is Antonio Alves, and I am the president of the Ontario Framers Association. Mm-hmm. And our organization is a non-profit organization. You can find us on the web at www.OntarioFramersAssociation.com, and you can sign up in our guest book, and you can give us some comments and suggestions. I've been a construction worker for 15 years, and I come from an immigrant family that came to Canada over 20 years ago, and so I can relate to a lot of the matters that are going on today in the work field with migrant workers and with immigrant workers, temporary workers, you know, and safety issues and, you know, those sort of things.
About the vigil, it was in January 7th. I'm just giving a backgrounder. There was a public vigil for migrant workers that were killed at work in Toronto, and the location was at a building 2757 Kipling Avenue, where the swing stage scaffolding that they were working on broke, and 4 workers plummeted 13 stories down to the concrete below, and a 5th man is in critical condition. We were at the vigil, and there was people coming from all over the place. There's a bunch of people from Guelph that came, a van full of us. And so people gathered to commemorate and celebrate the lives of these workers and to commemorate the countless workers that were killed or maimed on the job, and definitely to demand justice for workers all across this nation and their families, and also to demand reparations, to persecute those responsible, like employers, recruiters of these workers and government officials in some way, so that there's no impunity there and that those that are precariously employed be protected.
Yeah.
Can you talk a bit about the financial expenses that an employer would need to invest in order to ensure that the right safety equipment?
I can do that. And you know what? In fact, I can give you a little bit of an underlayment of the real situation with that. Okay, and it all comes down to regulation of the construction work that's taking place. See, in Toronto, a lot of people are building illegally. They don't take out permits. They just go and they build. They don't have the proper licenses to do the stuff they do, and there's very little regulation in this. So what this does is it makes it really tough for people who are professionals and who are in the trades and in the construction industry to basically make a profit. So now they're facing themselves competing against these people who aren't paying taxes, who aren't paying insurance, who aren't paying WSIB premiums, and they're bidding on the same projects, right? So what this does is this drives down the value of the service, and that's exactly what it does. It devalues the service, and then these employers find themselves with a very fine line to make a profit in these situations. And so, no, the safety equipment is not expensive. You know, it's not that, and working safe is not more expensive than working unsafe. Typically, what happens is that because of the nature of the business, like I said, you know, it's a really tough competition. Employers will overlook these issues, and unfortunately, when it turns out bad, it's really bad, you know. I bet you that any employer out there that finds himself with an injured worker scenario and now a WSIB on their back, right, I guess, investigating isn't going to be a happy employer, right? I mean, so that's the way I see it.
From my understanding, harnesses and the right safety equipment?
The safety line, a rope grab, a lanyard.
Aren't they pretty expensive, like $250?
Well, if you think about it, they're in comparison with the person's life, they're not. Employers should be out there putting workers' lives in risk as a harness, you know, is $250, and not just for the harness, right, but the whole system of fall arrest protection, mm-hmm. Yeah, and all those things, then they do add up. So, and that's just for one person, right? And you must get this for all people, right? Because if you don't use it like that, then the system isn't adequate. If you just use, for example, the safety line with the rope grab directly attached to the 5-point harness, to the hook on it, then if you fall, you don't have you don't have a shock absorber, a lanyard or a shock absorber, right? And so that can potentially hurt you, you know, that can, you know, you can, you have a potential injury coming out of a situation like that. What it is adequate for is for travel restraint. If you want to use that for travel restraint, then you can, but you have to give yourself a limitation with the lifeline. You know, you cannot make the lifeline longer than the surface of the area that you're working on. And so people are trained. I know that a lot of people out there are trained, but they're not using common sense. And when their employers are just asking them to do the work, people are not, you know, second guessing their employer or their supervisor, you know. Sometimes it's important that we do.
Interestingly enough, the idea is brought up a lot that workers should take more responsibility of their situation in light of recent examples of employers failing to protect them. However, what my view is, and many people have the position that what becomes important to keep in mind and is something that is often not touched on is the fact that migrant workers face particular vulnerabilities inherent in their status that diminish their abilities to speak out and defend themselves against any and all abuses they face. As currently people working undocumented and those working under migrant labor programs are very disposable, there are many cases where workers are sent home when they voice concerns of health and safety or rights, etc. And if sent home, these workers lose the limited opportunity to maintain a livelihood as the lack of opportunities in their homeland is the catalyst for their entering into these programs or being non-status. And then at home, they often experience severe hardships and struggle to get by within the context of permeating and destructive imperialist Western economic activity. So the line becomes complicated between the idea of agency and that of structural vulnerability. There's a recognition that there is a need for their participation in the fight for justice in their lives, but they need to be put in a position of power to stand up for themselves. There's a recognition that there are severe structural problems, and for example, government policy that inhibits them from, you know, standing up for themselves, and that our immigration system, the Canadian immigration system, is not designed to make it easy for these people to stand up for themselves. So it's basically failing to protect them. Those was my thoughts, and I was wanting to add that. What do you think of that? At one point, you had mentioned that it would be great if people had more common sense and that they can take more responsibility and second-guess their employers. And this is the
challenge the environment a little bit, yes.
So hearing this response that I was thinking of, what do you think of the side of where some people really do believe that people have agency? A lot of people don't see those obstacles. Because a lot of people...
I wish I could put all that in those beautiful words that you put it in. That's absolutely right what you said. It's just that... There's a lot in what you said. You know, you made it very thick.
Thanks. Earlier in the interview,
yeah, I was asking about the expenses because trying to shed light on the fact that sometimes there are employers who may want to not have to expend that much to ensure those protections because they want to save money on that end.
It's a very tough competition for them, between them and the people not paying taxes and not paying insurance. Sometimes not even paying their workers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes it very tough to make a profit and still provide all safety equipment, you know, because safety equipment is expensive. I mean, a harness is $450. A rope grab is $100. Around, you know, like average, to make it vary, you know, depending on who one get it. But yeah, a shock absorber is going to be another 60 or 70 meters. Then the lifeline, depending on you get it, maybe 50 feet or 100 feet, then it's still going to cost you a couple hundred dollars. So, yeah, it actually costs up to thousands of dollars for each individual to be properly, to have the proper safety equipment from jobs that are more than 10 feet high.
Yeah, and you were saying earlier that that place, building 2757 Kipling Avenue in Toronto, that that site wasn't approved for the work to happen there, the construction work. I read that there was a cease and desist order issued at that site, but the workers were still forced to work on the site.
Right. Typically what happens is when the ministry comes on site and finds rules that are broken, they have the ability to shut down the job sites and ask for no more production work to be carried on. Except for the safety work, which is, you know, usually putting up safety railings where needed or covering up openings, holes that, you know, can potentially have someone fall through and that sort of stuff. And maybe put up ramps and stuff like that wherever it's needed. And normally after that, they should definitely check, I mean, how much equipment is on site. I mean, if there's seven workers and there's a swing stage and there's only two safety lines, the ministers are very qualified to know these things and to spot the red flags, you know? So the fact that that job was stopped, that had a stop work order, and then the job was the stop work order was lifted, and they carried on with production. It raises a red flag on the behavior of the ministry. It should make us question that whether the ministry is actually doing everything they can to ensure that the workers are safe. And from my perspective, from my personal opinion, I suggest that the ministry would enforce the rules and hold the people that are responsible, accountable for these things, the employers, not to waste time on the employees as they have been doing for many years, you know. I think they've just been wasting their time punishing the employees for the employers' wrongdoings and shortcomings.
There was a fifth person who survived the 13-story fall, and he's in critical condition, so he'll definitely need medical attention for the rest of his life. And I was wondering if you knew about what will happen to him, like whether or not he will be deported, like a lot of other workers who are injured at the workplace, which is a horrible fate because most people who are deported are unable to access full health care, full care in the countries that they're deported to. Also, workers without full status are often denied just compensation when they're injured.
That's a really good point, Mary. You know, I love the fact that you're pointing that out because that is so true. And what a shame that is, you know, that the same government that allows a Canadian company to hire workers from somewhere other than Canada to do not just labor work, but some high skilled work, because after all, building restoration is one of the highest skilled works in the construction industry. So the fact that the government allows a Canadian company to hire migrant workers to do this type of work, and then in the event that, like this incident that happened, where there were fatalities and there's an injured worker, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to be, I don't want to say anything, you know, that I don't want to, you know, speak on things that I don't know about, but I don't know if there's anything in place for this poor gentleman. You know, I hope that there is. I hope that the Canadian government, at the same time that allows this Canadian company to hire this migrant workers, that in the event that they are injured, that there's going to be some sort of a way to help them to deal with their injuries, I would suppose.
Yeah, I was just asking you, just in case you knew of some possibilities of what the government can do, or if you knew any examples of what has happened to deal with these kind of situations in the past. You know?
Yeah.
I was wondering if you knew anything about any compensation that the families of the four workers that plummeted to their death on Christmas Eve 2009, do you know anything about the compensation that they'll receive from the government?
Well, other than the donations that the people made and that the accounts that were set up for them, the trust accounts that were set up for them, I don't think that the Canadian government helped them out in any way, not to my knowledge anyhow.
Can you explain what you're referring to? Talk a bit about the organizations that you're referring to that have set up, or do you know much about it, that have set up the fund?
Well, no, I'm speaking from, because I was I attended the vigil on January 7th
right.
At the location there, the accident, and I heard that there were some accounts set up for them
right.
where people can donate, and there were some donations, I saw some people donating to the families. But I don't know if any sort of help from the government has been given to them.
Right. Okay. So I'm going to look that up so that I can announce it. Okay. I want to give out some information about a trust fund that has been created to support the families of the four men who died in the scaffolding accident. The four men, and my apologies in advance if my pronunciation of the names of these men that were killed at the workplace is poor. The trust fund has been created to support the families of Alexei Bloomberg, Waldemar Korostin, Alexander Bondarev, and Faizela Fazilov. The donations can be placed in the, this is the title of the trust fund, it's called Tragedy on Christmas Eve Trust Fund at TD Bank account 10766432077. Again, it's called Tragedy on Christmas Eve Trust Fund at TD Bank account 10766432077. Okay, so can you tell us a bit about your perspective on immigration and relating those issues to the construction industry, or even just how you feel media or Canadian politics or dominant culture relates to immigration?
Okay. Well, from my understanding, there's about a quarter of a million legal immigrants that come into Canada yearly, and immigration in Canada has been doing this for a long period of time, from my understanding. And these are the legal ones, right? There's another number of people that come to this country through other means, illegally, right? A lot of them, they come in as visitors, and their visas expire, their visitors' status expires, and they don't return. And so then they claim a refugee status, and they start their stay like this in Canada. Other ones come through the American border. And so it's a pretty large number of people that come in to Canada every year new people that need to adapt to the rules of our society that never had any training in our society. And all these people, they're going to need the most common, they're going to have the most common needs like everyone else. They're going to need to work and they're going to need to, have a place to live. And so the way they integrate to our society, it's quite a bit of friction, mm-hmm. And I think the government should put something in place to help the newcomers integrate a little bit better than they normally do, because a lot of them, they go to construction, they do construction work, because it's a work where typically if you're unskilled or untrained, you have a easier chance at entry to the workforce. And so because of this, it creates a lot of situations where the workers sometimes are not adequate for the job. They probably haven't got the proper training, or they haven't learned about the matter properly.